This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Ocean.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oakland.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We do extend a very special welcome to everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius Channel 93. And for those of you who have been with us listening to replays of previous Trainer Talk shows on a bit of a quiet week as we get ready for the Belmont meet coming up this weekend, we do want to welcome you back here for everybody who is tuning in on XM 209, and of course, everybody listening around the world at horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, and JT, another outstanding edition of Trainer Talk yet to come.
Yeah, really looking forward to talking to the trainers and hearing their stories. A little quiet week this week. No big racing till the weekend, but that's going to be fun too. So we should just get with it and hear these great stories.
And for those of you who were looking for our HRN Live racing coverage, which has become customary every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday afternoon from 3 to 6, and you're going to hear replays of previous Trainer Talk shows throughout the week because it is, as Jude mentioned, a very quiet week on the racing front. So we will regroup after Saratoga and dive into Belmont coming up this weekend and into next week on HRN Live. But without further ado, we do introduce our first of two special guests on the program tonight. Leah Giramati will be with us for the first half of the show, and Danny Pites will be with us in the second half of the program tonight. And Leah, somebody who has really made a mark for herself on the trainer side of things. She's also a former jockey. We'll talk to her about that. But she recently picked up her 199th career winner, and it came in grade one fashion at Saratoga. Leah, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much.
Happy to have you aboard here tonight. And I mentioned that victory this past weekend coming in the spinaway at Saratoga. I know it meant an awful lot to you and to your career, and it kind of sounded a little something like this.
And the field is coming for the top of the stretch. On the outside, it's Sweet Reason who has swept to the lead. Sweet Reason is in front. On the far outside is Stop Charging Maria. Then comes Dancing House with an eighth of a mile to the finish. It's Sweet Reason by four. Then Stop Charging Maria, followed by Dancing House and True Blue Nation. Sweet Reason, much the best in the spinaway. Sweet Reason won by six. Stop Charging Maria was second. Dancing House finished third in 1:23.2.
I thought we'd start with a little trip down memory lane.
That's a good memory, a very good memory.
Yeah, congratulations on that. Boy, was she impressive. Some filly.
Oh, she really is. She really is. She's always been impressive in the morning just in terms of dealing with her and just such a classy, classy filly. But she's never, her first race, her maiden race where she won so impressively, and then obviously the spinaway, it did take me by surprise. I wasn't prepared for that type of performance, so it was great.
Yeah, it has to feel good. How many times have you watched the replay?
I watched it so many times that same day, just over and over. I haven't actually watched it since that day, so, but it's imprinted in my memory now. I've memorized it. So.
Burned on the mental disc.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I mentioned that was your first grade one win of your career. I'm sure there's many more in the future, but walk us back to the beginning, Leah, and tell us about how you got hooked on the sport of thoroughbred racing and how everything came about for you.
Well, I started when I was very young doing the show horse thing. I rode jumpers and I traveled all over the country doing that. And I think it was because my father was tired of paying the bills. In between high school and college, he got me a job on the racetrack. My godfather had a piece of a horse with Alan Jerkins. So he got me a summer job on the racetrack, which I was not happy about at all because I wanted to do the show horses and I didn't know anything about racehorses and didn't want to know anything about them. But my mind quickly changed. I got a job with Alan Jerkins, just walking hots for the first day, and then he saw that I could get on some horses, so I started galloping for him, and then I didn't want to go to college. That was it. So my father wasn't very happy about it. He thought he was being slick, getting me the job on the racetrack to avoid me traveling all over the place during the summer, and it backfired on him a little bit. So I stuck around the racetrack for a few years, and then I did take a little break and went back to college. So I did finish my education and kind of went a different direction for a while. But then I came back, as everybody does on the racetrack, I think.
Yeah. Where'd you go to school?
I went to Samford University in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm. Did you study anything?
I got my master's down there, too, at the same school.
Anything equine-related, or was it completely unrelated?
No, it was theology, actually. It was my undergraduate was philosophy and religion, and then my master's is in theology.
Very cool. That's great.
Well, we refer to Jude as the pontiff of the pick four on the program, so I hope that's not blasphemy.
No. There's a little bit of theology in everything you do, so.
So what was it that finally, you mentioned working with Alan Jerkins, but you said that you didn't care for the thoroughbreds at first. What was it that finally made you think, okay, this is pretty cool, I can be part of this?
Well, it wasn't that I didn't care for them. I had no exposure to them. So there was nobody in my family that was interested in the racetrack. And the show horse world and the racetrack world is they're pretty separate. There's not a lot of intermingling, other than maybe you have horses that are retired racehorses that are converted into show horses. There were a lot of thoroughbreds that I rode as riding jumpers. But other than that, there's not a lot of mingling between the two. So it was just a lack of exposure. As soon as I got to the racetrack, I loved it. I loved it. And it's very hard to leave the racetrack. Anybody that's been on the racetrack knows how hard it is to leave. It gets in your blood, and that's it.
Yeah, you can't stay away for very long. In California, there is a little bit more crossover between the show horse and the racetrack, and I think for a lot of the same reasons you mentioned, your dad got tired of paying the bills. You can't put the ribbons in the bank, but
right.
Once the show horse people figure out that you might actually be able to almost break even with a racehorse, it becomes right. A lot more appealing. I had a couple of friends, Alan Severinsen, Doc Severinsen's son, trained horses in California for many years. He came up from the show horses, and Daryl Vienna, who still trains a little bit, although he's gone off the beaten path to be a lawyer and a chemist and some other things.
Up here you have also on the East Coast, you have Rodney Jenkins, who was one of the greatest riders of all time, the greatest Grand Prix riders, and Michael Matt as well. Great, great show horse rider, and they're great trainers now. So you do have it here, but it's more like they move from one world to the other. Not they don't necessarily dabble in both at the same time.
Right.
Was there anything, Leah, that you were able to take away from working with the eventing horses and the show horses and transfer it into helping you with what you're doing today or even in your riding career?
Sure. I mean, I think the greatest thing is, as a rider, you learn all the basics and you learn them properly. Unfortunately, now there's not a lot of opportunity for riders who want to learn to ride. Well, I mean, they have the jockey schools, that's great. But the majority of riders on the racetrack, they start out as grooms and they jump up on a horse and if they're lucky enough that a trainer allows them to get on a racehorse and helps them, but they kind of have to learn as they go. Whereas with the show horses, there's too many to even talk about, all the little things, just how your hands, your legs, your seat, you know, your balance, just the way you school horses and everything from the way you walk a horse down the shed road to the way you take it, turn it out or turn it around or start a horse off or warm it up. I think the show horse, having a background with show horses is a tremendous advantage.
Yeah, a lot of times people say that, you know, exercise riders ride English, and it always cracks me up because that's like saying, you know, Castilian Spanish is the same as Spanglish. I mean, it's like two entirely different. Riding a racehorse is about maybe 20% English equitation, you know. So I think you're 100% correct. I mean, if you know the basics of riding a horse the proper way, it's just got to help you with the racehorses.
It does. It really does. It does.
Leah Jeremati joining us on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Leah, how cool is it to be able to say that you worked with the chief, Alan Jerkins?
That's the greatest. It's probably the greatest time of my life has been being around him, whether it's been working for him or even now just being training on my own. He's my go-to person for advice or for a pick-me-up if I need it, or even after this race, he's the first person I want to hear from, you know, to say well done or pat me on the back. He's an incredible horseman, which everybody knows, but he's also an incredible human being. I mean, anybody that's been around him would say that. He's so inspiring. He really is.
Did he contact you after you won the Spinaway?
Sure. He called.
What was that conversation like? Had to be special.
Of course, we had dinner the next night, but I see him every day. So after training, I'm over at his barn and we catch up on whatever went on that day. So I see him very, very regularly.
So what made you decide that you were going to try the riding thing first before becoming a trainer?
Well, it wasn't intentional. I didn't really decide it. I had gone down to Alabama to go to school, and I had finished my master's, and I headed back up to New York because I got into a PhD program at Drew University in New Jersey. So the plan was I would get on horses in the morning to help pay bills, and then I was going in the afternoon and evening and working on my PhD. And at some point, and I was getting on horses for Alan, and at some point, for whatever reason, I dropped a lot of weight, and I was in my mid-30s, and Alan said to me, you know, when you were a kid and you were working, you always wanted to ride, but you were a little too heavy. Why don't you want to ride this horse that you've been getting on every morning, because he's kind of a project horse, and you'd probably be okay with him. So I thought, okay, that would be fun. So the horse's name was Forest Lover, and it was just supposed to be kind of a one-time thing, and I rode him. I won with him on the third start. So I rode him three times, and we won on the third start. And I thought, well, this is easy. I can do this. That was the end of school for a while, or at least up until now. I haven't gone back. So I didn't finish my PhD, but I started a riding career that was not very successful, and I wasn't very good. I was okay, and I made enough to pay the bills, but nothing to – it wasn't a stellar career. It was fun, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot about that aspect of the business, so I'm glad I did it.
Have you spent your life disappointing your father?
Probably. Although now I think he's not so disappointed. He probably was a little bit worried when I stopped school again and went back to the racetrack, but I think he's over that.
Well, we have to tell you, up until this point, we thought Michelle Nihe was maybe the most well-educated trainer we've had the chance to speak with. But your resume, educationally speaking, it really speaks for itself.
Thanks. I think she has a PhD in biology, though, doesn't she? So I never
think
finished
so.
My PhD.
Yeah.
So.
But you still have time.
You still got it on me.
So talk about making that transition from a jockey to a trainer. We've heard several trainers on this program say that they've made that transition and done it successfully, much like you have. Talk about that day when you decided, hey, I'm going to hang this up and I'm going to focus on training horses.
Okay, well, that was another thing that I didn't actually decide. It was decided for me. I knew that I wasn't going to be very successful as a jockey. And I thought about going back to school, but this time I thought maybe I would try to get into law school. And I there was a trainer who had some owners that were that taught at a law school, and he introduced me to them, and that would be Steve and Jean Zorn, who are now the head of Castle Village Farm. And we got together and sat down for lunch, and I was really interested in women's issues in law, and that's exactly what she was teaching. I think at Fordham. I'm not positive about that. But then they talked me into claiming a horse with them, and just doing this for the summer, mind you. It was only going to be a Saratoga thing, and then I would try to get into law school for the fall. Of course, we claim the horse. The horse finishes second at Saratoga and then wins the Maryland Million. And, of course, law school went right out the window. So again, I find that I don't make a lot of decisions in life. They're made for me, and that's okay. It's been a great ride, so I'm okay with that.
With your theology background, it sounds like God takes the upper hand sometimes.
Yes. There you go. That just shows you. You can plan and plan and plan, and God has a way of maneuvering you in spite of yourself.
Leah, which person or people have had the biggest influence on your career?
Well, without a doubt, Alan Jerkins, for sure. I would say he's really the main impetus and motivation for me. Because even when I came back here, the only reason I came back to New York and thought, well, I'll get on horses in the morning, it was because I missed him. I really missed him in my life. He's such an inspiring person, and not just because he's great and you just want to do what he's done. He has a way of, well, you said something about disappointing my father. Alan has a way of just making your day when he shows you that you've done something well, and crushing you if he's disappointed with you. And I missed that. I just really missed it. I felt like when I came back and started, I came back during the summer one year, just for like a week, and I asked, oh, can I get on a horse just to mess around? And it was up here at Saratoga, and it was the horse Chief's Crown. He puts me on that horse in the morning. I hadn't been on a horse in years, and he tells me to go around Little Clare Court, which is a little half-mile track here at Saratoga, like a little pony track. And I went around three times, and I was exhausted. My legs were all rubbery. I thought, wow, I can't wait to get off this horse. And then he told me, let's go breeze 5/8. And I thought, what? I haven't been on a horse in 5 years or 4 years. He says, that's okay. You'll be okay. I said, well, I'm going to need a pony. And he takes me out there with the pony, drops me off. I worked the 5/8. They pick me up because I wouldn't have been able to pull the horse up. And, of course, the time was perfect. Everything was great. And then we're going off the track, and he says to me, I'm putting this horse in the stake in about 5 days. I said, you just asked me to breeze a horse that you're going to run in a stake, and I haven't been on a horse in 5 years? I said, yeah, well, sometimes the first time you do something after a long time of not doing it, you do it perfectly. After that, it's downhill, he said.
So
it was things like that just would pump you up and just get you so excited about what you're doing, and I missed that. And I guess that he's the reason I came back to the track, really. And he's really the reason why I do anything. Everything I do, if I do it well, I can't wait to find out whether he saw it, you know. And he's just very inspiring, and he's done that for a lot of people. I'm certainly not the only one.
So. You wear your WWJD bracelet, right? What would Jerkins do?
Believe me, I'm always over there asking him. I don't know what to do. Should I work the horse this far or this far? And you know, he's always got great advice, that's for sure.
Leah Giramonte, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fayze Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Leah, are there some of those same qualities that you try to incorporate into your operation today and when you're working with the people that you have to work with?
Yes, I mean, I hope so. I try to be inspiring as much as I can to everybody. If I see somebody that I think is talented that might not have been noticed, whether it's a groom or a hot walker, or if I see somebody to me, the biggest thing is you have to love the animal, because there are a lot of people in the business that they just see it as a business, or it's just a job, or it's just a paycheck at the end of the week. I really want people around my horses that love the horses, that play with them and cut them. And I, you know, it's not, they're not machines. They're animals, you know, and they want to be loved and they want affection and they want to be told they did the right thing too. So I try to encourage those people around me that I see that quality in. You know, I can't say that I don't do it the same way Alan does it. Everybody has their own way of inspiring people, but I hope I am. I think that's what we're all here for. We need to inspire other people and lend a helping hand when we can. And that's what it's all about, because next time it'll be you that needs the helping hand.
Yeah, there's no question about that. What's your basic training style? What kind of horses do you like to train? You like turf? You like sprinters? Do you have anything that you just kind of specialize
in? Right now, it's 2-year-old fillies going 7-8
on a sloppy main track.
I'd say right now that's my specialty. I think whatever. I don't know that I have one. Maybe somebody from the outside looking in would say I'm better with certain horses than others, but I think it's just a matter of having the horse that can do it. I don't mind project horses. I like horses that might need a little extra time and attention, and maybe try to do something different. And that would be something that I think I learned a lot from Alan about, that you don't always have to have the same routine, and every horse is different, just like any child is different. You can't treat every child the same if you're raising a child. So you have to be creative, you know, and if something isn't working, try something else, try something nobody else did. You know, I don't think I have any one particular type of horse that I do better with, but I do think that, I guess my strong point might be a horse that somebody else just isn't clicking with because they're not fitting into their program. Maybe they have a lot of horses and the horses have to get out in a timely manner, and there's no options for them because there's no time. There's no way to just take an hour walk, let's say, you know, in between, before they train or after they train. So maybe that would be something I could offer that somebody else doesn't. But I don't know that there's any one particular type of horse that I do any better with, but maybe somebody else could answer that better than I could.
Well, since you alluded to your grade one spinaway winner, Sweet Reason, and who obviously was so impressive, I'm going to go out on a limb, Leah, and say that that was probably the biggest win of your career, at least the most memorable to this point. Tell us the story of Sweet Reason and this filly and how she came into your barn and how you got her to this point.
Well, I have the owner of Sweet Reason, who's Jeff Treadway. We met about 5 years ago, and we started going to the sales. We were just doing the 2-year-old sales, and he was picking horses out, and he's very intelligent. He's very learned. He knows pedigrees, and so he was very active in picking out the horses and making up lists for me to look at when I got to the sale. And he's put up a decent amount of money every year, and we've had some decent horses, nothing spectacular like this filly, of course. But he's definitely invested the money every year so that you just knew that eventually you're going to find a good one if you can hold on. And he, you know, it took about 4 years, and we finally got one that not only had talent, but nothing, no humps, no bad luck, no, because that's more than half the game. That's 3/4 of the game. There's a lot of talented horses, but something happens, you know, one way or another. You have all sorts of little glitches that keep them from being what they potentially can be. Anyway, last year was the first year that we went to the Keeneland sale that for yearlings. Up until then, he was just buying 2-year-olds. So we went down together, and he had a list, and we both looked at all of them together, and this filly was one of the yearlings that we picked out as our first choice. We bought 3 yearlings at that sale, but she was the one that we were most excited about, I think. The other two were very, very nice, but I think she was the one we wanted to go home with. So we bought her, and she went to Croupy's Newcastle Farm down in Ocala to get broke, and they do a great job. His horse has come up from Ocala acting like older horses, like they've seen everything. So that always makes it much easier. And that was it. She's a pretty easy filly to train. She does whatever you ask her to do. She doesn't do any more or any less than you ask her. And that's all.
Well, it was pretty remarkable.
Simple. I don't know why we can't just do that all the time.
Yeah, exactly. If it was easy, everybody would do it, right? Well, Lee, we can't thank you enough for being with us here tonight. Hard to believe that the 25 minutes or so has flown by. It's already over with, but want to thank you for taking time to be part of Trainer Talk tonight and really enjoyed hearing your story. And you'll have to join us again because I think we just scratched the surface on your career and want to wish you all the best moving forward as well.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, Leah Giramonte, our special guest on the first half of Trainer Talk tonight, all presented by Phasic Tipton. And JT, do want to remind our listeners that they can visit the Phasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearling Sale on September 30th. 390 yearlings by 157 different sires going to be offered for sale at the Phasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearling Sale coming up on September 30th.
Yeah, it's a great sale. A lot of nice horses come out of there.
Yeah, so many ways. Grade 1 Spinaway winner, the Delaware Oaks winner, Dancing of Fleet, the daughter of Mid-Atlantic sales grad of Fleet Alex also coming out of that sale.
Cool.
And of course, all of our guests who appear live on the program going to receive a gift from EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those to Leah. And we'll get him to our second guest, Danny Pites. He's coming up next on the second half of Trainer Talk, all presented by Phasic Tipton.
Phasic Tipton welcomes nominations now for the November sale, the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. 15 horses in 2012 sold for $1 million and higher, more than any other mixed sale in the world. Exceptional weanling market, with foals selling for up to $620,000. Horse of the Year Hover de Grace sold for $10 million, the world's highest priced auction thoroughbred of 2012. The November sale at Phasic Tipton in Kentucky. Nominate now.
Now you can help your equine athlete heal faster and recover stronger with Ultras Elite, a wearable low-intensity therapeutic ultrasound system that has been used successfully to treat splints, suspensory ligament and tendon injuries, muscle strains, stiff joints, and bone fractures. Ultras Elite is clinically proven to reduce swelling and inflammation, increase joint flexibility, and reduce pain and irritation. For more information, visit ultras.com. Ultras, heal faster, recover stronger.
EPO Equine, the all-natural, healthy, safe, and legal blood builder, would like to extend a special congratulations to Nick and Martha Gonzalez and the entire team of this year's Queen's Plate winner, Midnight Aria, as well as Tony Alanya and all the connections of the remarkable Captain Treacherous, winner of the Metro and Meadowlands Pace. To learn more about how EPO Equine can help your equine athlete reach its true potential, contact Joe Valente at 215-501-6880 or visit epoequine.com. I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, makers of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, here in North America, horsemen are protecting their horses with Flair strips. Are the strips benefiting horses in other parts of the world?
Mike, horsemen around the world use the strips to protect lung health. For example, South African Horse of the Year Variety Club regularly races with a strip. In South Africa, many graded stakes, including Grade 1 stakes, have been won in 2013 by horses wearing the strips. In New Zealand, Reigning Horse of the Year Mufasa races with a strip, as well as many thoroughbred and standardbred stakes winners in Singapore and Australasia this season.
To learn more, visit flairstrips.com.
RaceHorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RaceHorseReport.com. Make RaceHorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RaceHorseReport.com.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Phasic Tipton.
Okay, welcome back to the second half of Trainer Talk presented by Fazy Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, our producer Lee Della Pina in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Of course, all of our guests who appear live on the program do receive gifts courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips and EPO Equine. And EPO would like to send a special congratulations to Diane Alvarado, the trainer of the $200,000 Greenwood Cup winner, El Daffer, on this past Monday. So congratulations to Diane, a, of course, proponent of EPO Equine.
It was a big win. Yeah. Nice horse.
Fun visit, first half of the show with Leah Giramati, and looking forward to our guest in the second half of the program. That's trainer Danny Pites. He has recorded 345 career winners with earnings of more than $12 million. He is a native of Conway, Arkansas, and he's nice enough to spend a little time with us to tell us his story tonight on Trainer Talk. And Danny, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And boy, those 345 winners, very, very impressive. And then we look back on how you got started in Arkansas. Take us back to the beginning and tell us how Danny Pites got hooked on horse racing.
Oh, my stepdad, big racing fan, took me to the races when I was 14 years old at Oakland Park, gave me $20, said then there was only a $2 double and a no exactos of anything. He said, here's get you a $2 double and you have $2 to race to bet. And off I went and got started really just as a fan. Secretariat came along in 73. I was a big Secretariat fan, and just something about the racing and horse racing kind of captured my imagination. I got out of high school there in Little Rock, went a year and a half at ULR there in Little Rock, and wasn't really applying myself, and thought, you know, why don't I go down here and get a job on the racetrack and then see if that's something I would want to do for a living, and I'm still here. I went to work for Paul Adwell, the trained elocutionist, won the Preakness in 75. I started in 77 for him, worked a couple years for him. Very good man. He treated me good. Learned a lot from him. And then I went to work for Joe Canty in Hot Springs, that the winter of 79. And I went to New York with him and was just a groom. He had Cox's Ridge in the barn.
Wow.
I went to work for him. And then that year, a two-year-old came in the barn by the name of Temperance Hill, and I got to be part of that, though I was not grooming the horse. I was in the barn. The year 80, he won, ended up being the Eclipse Award winner, won the Arkansas Derby, the Belmont, the Super Derby, the Jockey Go Club, the Travers. The Travers was probably his biggest win, and kind of worked my way up from a groom to a foreman to an assistant. And learned a whole lot from Joe. I was around a lot of good horses, and he was a very good horseman. And he retired at an early age. Moved back to Camden, South Carolina, and this would have probably been kind of the fall of 86, the spring of 87, and he encouraged the clients he had to give me a shot, and a lot of them did.
You know, it's interesting, Danny.
I had horses to train, you know, maybe 20-something horses when I first went out on my own. The number dwindled down some, and now I have, you know, I'm back up, and I have two very good clients I train for, the Lowe's and Shadwell, Robert and Luana Lowe and Shaq Hamdam's Shadwell Farm. So I'm very lucky and blessed to have two owners like that, and I've had horses for them for quite a while.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the name Joe Canty, because that's a name that we've heard referenced several times in talking with trainers on this program over the past few months. Joe Canty, somebody that's had an influence on so many current trainers' careers, and that had to be an amazing time to be with Joe. You mentioned Cox's Ridge and Temperance Hill. I think Majesty's Prince was the other one that was there.
Oh, he was a very nice grass horse. You know, wanted to run a mile and three-eighths, a mile and a half. Absolutely loved the soft ground. I think he's kind of a little bit of an underappreciated horse. I think John Henry was running at the time, and, you know, he was kind of took a back seat to him, but the horse had won the Man of War and the Sword Dancer consecutive years as a four-year-old. He, at Belmont, both years he won those races, and as a three-year-old, he won the Rothmans. I think as a four-year-old, he got beat a neck or something, and the Rothmans came back and won it again as a five-year-old. So just a horse that wanted to run all day, and the softer was, the better he was.
A lot of horses took a back seat to John Henry, so he should don't have to feel too bad about that.
Yeah. No, not at all.
Were you raised around horses at all, or was it strictly just
not
the racetrack?
Not at all. Not at all.
Because it's amazing.
You know, the front end of the back end of the horse when I went on the racetrack. I knew how to bet on them. Yeah. I knew how to ready racing for them.
Well, that happens. You said you were from Little Rock or in that area.
I grew up in Little Rock.
A lot of people, you know, even though Arkansas is there's a lot of rural areas. I mean, you were probably more of a city boy, and a lot of people.
I was a city boy. Yeah, tell everybody that because they think I'm from Arkansas. I'm a, you know, a country boy, but I grew up in Little Rock. I was a city boy.
Yeah, and for city boys, the only place you can see horses, if you like horses at all, is at the racetrack. So it's rather amazing that you were around so many good horses when you were young, since Oaklawn in those days wasn't the Oaklawn that we have now, and the big purses and the graded stakes and all of that stuff.
Right.
And there weren't nearly as many trainers that focused on or took their stables to Arkansas. So that was incredible, that run you were on.
I was very fortunate, you know, to get on with Joe Canny, because he did have those kind of, he was training for John Ed Anthony, obviously the Live Lolly then, and had a lot of nice horses, and Joe had quite a run there of having at least one real good horse in the barn. Cox's Ridge was maybe the most naturally talented horse that I was ever around. He was just this big, massive 17 plus, and look, you know, I was telling her, describing him as almost an 18-hand quarter horse. He was so big and wide. A lot of horses are 17 hands or something. They're not wide bodies too. And he was just this big, massive horse that was very talented. Not the soundest horse in the world. Never wanted to win by very far. He'd always get to the lead and then want to lay on the horse next to him that was his competitor. He'd always win by neck or head, half a length. He never seemed to draw off and win, but was just an amazing horse to be around, and especially me having only been on the racetrack a couple years or something. But then as he was getting ready to retire, here comes Timbers Hill in the barn as a two-year-old. And, you know, we got to Oakland that spring. He was a maiden, and he left there as an Arkansas Derby winner and wasn't nominated to the Derby and the Triple Crown thing, and supplemented to the Belmont, wins in the slot, pays $108, wins the Travers. I always said the Travers I thought was his best race he'd ever ran in his life. And then we're coming on, you know, getting ready to run in the Super Derby. Then it was $500,000. This was all pre-Breeders' Cup. I don't think there was any races in the country that were more than $500,000. He wins the Super Derby and turns around 2 weeks later and wins the Jockey Gold Cup, and it was $500,000. So in 2 weeks' time, he won two races that were $500,000 races, and they were as big as anything in the country. So,
do you find yourself now, like when you're looking at horses at a sale or whatever, gravitating to the pedigrees with Cox's Ridge and Temperance Hill in them?
Oh, when I see them, it does make me, does bring back memories, makes me take an extra hard look at them and stuff. But not too many Temperance Hill, you know, in any of the pedigrees. A little more, you see maybe some Cox's Ridge mares or something, something where he might be, you know, in the second dam or something, by Cox's Ridge or something. But they were nice horses. I think, you know, I think Casas Ridge was a little more naturally talented than Pimentel was.
Visiting with trainer Dan Pites on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Danny, you mentioned that you started the game kind of like I did, just as a fan and betting on horses, and that was the one thing you knew. I was the same way when I moved from Massachusetts to Kentucky. I didn't know anything about the breeding end of it and what went on with that aspect of it. But eventually, just like you, you end up learning these things. What were some of the first recollections you have of walking into Joe Canty's barn and being around all these great horses? It had to be amazing.
I think I worked for Paul Adwell. He was a very good horseman and everything, but he was up there in age a little bit where he was not as hands-on and you know, at the barn as much as Joe was. And that was really my first recollection is when I went to work for Joe. I mean, he was there so early, he was just hands-on, didn't miss a thing. And it just right away, I said, this is how I want to be. This is the kind of horseman I want to be. I think somewhat I am. I pride myself in being hands-on. I enjoy being at the barn, enjoy coming out every day. I like to see my horses every day. I'm never happy when I'm split up and I can't see my horses. You know, I'm just something inside me that makes, you know, the way I am. And I don't begrudge the guy that has 200 or 300 horses and has 5 divisions. Hey, more power to you. If that's your thing, that's not my thing. I like to have everything and, you know, and 35, 40 horses, whatever, 50 if it's all in one place, and that would make me happy. I want to have to be split up, and I have more and more. I have had to because I've split between Oakland and Fairgrounds over the last few winters, and so I'll go about 3 or 4 months where I'm kind of going back and forth a little bit, but I'm never as happy when I'm not seeing my horses, and I think that's what the owners want too. They like have somebody that's actually the trainer that is training their horses, not an assistant.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of the hands-on approach, and I think you really get to know your horses intimately. The first time I met you was a couple years ago at Keeneland, and you didn't really know me from third base, but we were talking, and I said, you know, your horses look great on the track. You think you're going to have a big meeting? And you said, well, I don't know if my horses are either ready or good enough to compete here, but I think once we get to Arlington in the summer, we're going to do pretty good. And it was just like, you know, from your mouth to God's ears. Keeneland was a little rough. You maybe won a race or two, but then when you got to Arlington, things took off. And I think that's the kind of thing that a trainer that's hands-on knows, whereas somebody that's got horses all over the place doesn't have the same feel for.
Well, they're always trying to tell you something. If you're paying attention, I think you have to really be there, you know. And those guys, the Todd Pletchers and those guys, they have great assistants, I really, and they have, you know. But it's still, it's just not the same in my mind. It's not the same. I have a very good assistant, Jock McNeil is his name. He's worked for me for 4 years. Worked for Harry Trotsik for I don't know how many years, and he's. He's a lot like I am. He's very hands-on. He's a barn rat. I call him. He wants to be around the barn all the time. He loves the horses. But it's still not the same, you know, me seeing what he's trying to tell me. I need to see it myself to feel comfortable that I know exactly how the horse is and what he's doing.
Dan, you mentioned the names Robert and Luana Lowe earlier in the conversation here tonight, and they, of course, were the owners of, among others, Capote Bell, who is a filly that I can remember quite well growing up as a kid going to the races at Saratoga, and I still have pictures of Capote Bell, I believe in the post parade of the test or the ballerina, maybe both of those, because I used to go to the races and just snap pictures of these outstanding horses, and I know Capote Bell was not only a great racehorse, but certainly very special to you and to your career.
We're still looking for one like her all these years later. She won the test in 96. Actually, the Lowe's my first contact with them, and you know, just the connection of how you get owners. They own a trucking company, a very big trucking company, Prime Incorporated. They're based in Springfield, Missouri. I have a brother that works in the parts department of their garage of the trucking company. Robert's father, who has nothing to do with the trucking business, the trucking company, but used to come and hang out down in the garage area all the time, was somewhat friendly with my brother and saw some wind pictures of mine in my brother's work area and asked about who that was. And my brother told him that, you know, it was his brother and that he trained horses and stuff. And he said, really, Robert and Juana go to the races all the time at Oakland. They're really into the races, and they're thinking about maybe even buying a horse or something. A few days later, my brother got paged up to Mr. Lowe's office, and Mr. Lowe wanted to know, hey, would your brother give us some advice in getting in the horse racing game? And, of course, my brother called me and said, hey, people that own the company I'm working for would like to talk to you about maybe getting in the horse racing game. I had no idea. It would have been the fall of 93, and here we are, you know, 20 years later. I didn't know that I was going to train for him, and then I didn't know that we'd have a 20-year relationship. And these days, with owners changing trainers, you know, like they change their T-shirts or something, it's amazing that we've been together this long and that they've been so loyal to me.
Yeah, what makes that relationship work, Danny?
I think trust. I think they trust me. They know I'm always looking out for the horse. They know that I'm going to be honest with them about what's going on with the horses. That's, I think, what most owners are looking for, just somebody to be honest with them, tell them physically what's going on with the horses, you know, ability-wise what's going on with the horses, and it's worked. We've had some good runs. You know, we got the Derby with Steppenwolfer. We third in the Derby. We were second in the Oaks with the Real Cozy. We've been to the Breeders' Cup with the homebred of theirs, Green Fee. One of us run right here at Huntington Park. We were fifth in the Breeders' Cup Mile. We've had some slow times, which everybody goes through, and I've always told everybody through all the slow times, I've never had ever got the impression that they were thinking about making a change. And we've had some rough patches where horses have been getting hurt, and I almost expected them just to say, hey, we just need to make a change, just to make a change. We're having bad karma or something right now. But they've just stayed the course with me, and I've been very lucky to have somebody as loyal as them.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have that type of relationship with a thoroughbred owner. As you say, it's so rare these days. I mean, you know, there's constant switching around of trainers, and even when trainers have success with horses, they get fired. The late Eddie Gregson said there were only two kinds of trainers, those that have been fired and those that are going to get fired. And that's really the truth of it all. But congratulations to you for that. I mean, that's outstanding.
Yeah. You know, and my connection really with Shadwell goes back to Joe Canny. The farm was just established in 1985 in Kentucky. Was when Shea Condon's farm finally was finished and they first had horses in this country. And possibly 86, Joe ended up getting some horses for Shadwell. And then when he retired, he had encouraged him to leave the horses with me. And Rick Nichols, who was the general manager there then and is still the general manager, at that time he didn't really have any say in who was training the horses over. He was basically running the farm and concerned with the mares and stuff. But we had a good relationship. I spoke with him as much as I spoke with anybody else. And is we I had horses maybe for about a year for them or something, and then they went by the wayside, and that, they didn't send me any more. But I always saw Rick at the yearling sales, and he would always ask how I was doing, and he would always comment to me, and he'd like to get some horses with you again someday. And I was like, call me, please. And it wasn't until Kieran started going, he went kind of private for him. Kieran McLaughlin went to work for him and kind of went private for him and started going to Dubai in the winters and then coming back to New York in the summers. And it's probably maybe the second year that Kieran went over to Dubai. He had some horses that didn't really need to go to Dubai. They needed to stay here and just run here. They were cheaper horses or something. And then finally they called me. And I would have said, maybe this would have been the late 90s. They called me and said, okay, would you like to take 3 or 4 to Oakland? And I said, love to. And this just kind of started out 2 or 3 a year, and then a couple babies, and then, you know, the last 3 years, the move to Chicago really, well, Karen and I weren't stepping on each other's feet, both being at Belmont, and also coming to Arlington opened up, for me, more stalls. I was always kind of pigeon-toed into about 15 stalls at Belmont, and I could only take so many babies every year from them. Now that I've come to Arlington, I could get probably as many stalls as I could feel, and Shadwell's actually had more babies to send out. You know, I've probably had up to 20 to 25 horses for them. Maybe even a little more than that this summer. So,
I think most every trainer, Dan, would tell you that their one of their ultimate goals or one thing they would like to be part of at some point in their career would be the Kentucky Derby and running a horse on the first Saturday in May in that event.
Right.
And you've had the privilege to do that. You mentioned Steppenwolfer in 2006, who ran a tremendous race that day. When you look back on the 2006 Derby and that experience you had getting there and then going through it the week of Derby week, what stands out to you about that experience?
You know what really stood out? This might seem kind of strange, but how many people called me that week and just to wish me well? A lot of ex-owners I had, a lot of people that I'd trained for in the past, I didn't have horses for, but just friends, family, people in the horse racing business that I knew, but were just casual friends or acquaintances. I had so many people call or text me or something and just say, hey, man, we're happy to see you there. Good luck. And wish me well. And I think that was the biggest thing, one of the biggest things for sure. Probably the other thing was that my family's been around horse racing. You know, they come to the races all the time. They live in Hot Springs now, you know. So, but my wife's family, she's grew up in Iowa. She's a farm girl from Iowa. Her family and friends, they'd see wind pictures or something, but they'd never see her. You know, they never got to the races. They never actually got to experience what she was really doing. And when they were able to see her walking over with the horse, leading the horse on the offside, that was such a thrill for me, just because I knew that her family and her friends were actually finally going to say, there she is. She actually does do this. it was pretty neat. It was a great experience. Barbaro ran great. It was, we were basically third best that day, and we were still thrilled with that, but a little side story to that whole thing. I had never met Shea Condom. Even though I had trained for him for at that point, probably 6-7 years, I'd never actually met the man. And the only time he's come to the Derby, he had Jazzle in. And I thought I might actually meet him that week. I thought that he would possibly come over to see the horse train one morning or something. But he never did, and my conversation with Rick Nichols was, Rick, I'd like to meet Shea Condom. You know, is he not coming over early or something? He said, no. He said, just come and introduce yourself to him in the paddock. So I thought, and he was actually, I think we were in the two ho or something. Jazzo might have been in the one ho, so we were, that made it easy for, because we were saddling right next to each other. And I always tell everybody, it's not really exactly the, you know, with all the things that are going on and, you know, with the Derby and the mad scene that it is in the paddock, it's not exactly the greatest place in the world to meet an owner for the first time.
Especially
said,
a shake.
Then again, it's not a bad place to meet an owner for the first time because you're actually running a horse in the Derby, and that's got to mean something to him that you have one and that you were able to get there. And so since then, obviously, you know, he comes over for the yearling sale every year, and I get to walk around and look at horses with him, and we look at the homebreds and everything. So, you know, have a little bit more of a relationship with him now than I did then.
Not bad for a kid from Arkansas that grew up just betting on horses, didn't know which end was which.
I've been very lucky. I've been blessed. I've got good help, too. Besides good owners, I've been blessed to have good people work for me. That, you know, always, you have to have that.
I would have bet money that you would have met Sheikh Hamdan before I did, but it was the other way around. I was working the sales one year, I think it was 2001, actually, and Sheikh Hamdan was interested in this one particular horse that I was working for the consignment, and his plane was late, and he didn't get in until like 8 o'clock, and I volunteered to stay just because I wanted to meet Sheikh Hamdan. I volunteered to stay, and it was just me and one of the guys that was running the consignment, and we showed him this horse, which he didn't end up buying, but it was a great experience.
Right. Yeah.
Well, Dan, only about 2 minutes left here to wrap things up. It has really flown by. But what does Dan Pites like to do outside of the racetrack? What other hobbies do you have?
Not a whole lot. I used to play golf a little bit, but I don't do a whole lot of that. I play cards a little bit, but not a whole lot of that either. I'm pretty consumed with the horses and the training. It's a full-time job for sure, and it's a lifestyle. I tell everybody that they can't, you know, fathom working 7 days a week and no vacations and all that. I was like, you know, I don't really consider it a job. I don't. It's a lifestyle. I said it's when you're passionate about what you're doing, you don't can really consider it a job. And to have good owners makes it a lot easier, you know, to come in every morning and to have nice horses that come in and look down that shed row and see some heads poking out there, you know. Not all of them are nice horses, but if you have babies that have pedigrees, you think the potential is there. You're always looking for the next step and more for the next one that's going to take you to the Derby. So hopefully we have one in the barn or sometimes it's going to take us to the Oaks next year.
Well, Dan, this has been an amazing visit. We've really enjoyed hearing your story. So many great stories there over the course of the past half hour. And, of course, if any of our listeners happen to miss any portion of this interview or our interview with Leah Giramati in the first half of the show, they can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Later on tonight, a podcast will be available. Also, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Danny, thanks so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it. And we'll make sure we get you the gifts from our man, Joey Diamond, with EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll send those out to you.
Very good. Thanks, John, Jude. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thanks, well, Danny. Appreciate it.
Good luck with the jar.
Thank you. Bus jar for the Super Derby. And then the jar, maybe in the Gold in the Kentucky Cup or something, the mile and a half race the following weekend.
Perfect.
Go down there and run.
Good luck,
run
Danny.
Kentucky Downs with them. So.
Good luck.
Thanks, guys.
Dan Pites, Leah Giramati. Fun trainer talk presented by Fasig Tipton.
Excellent show. Excellent.
Yeah, really enjoyed those conversations. Again, if you missed it, go back to our website. Check it out, a podcast at horseracingradio.net. More replays coming up tomorrow. Trainer Talk replays from 3 to 6, and then our Brisnet.com call-in show live tomorrow night, 6 to 7 Eastern Time. On Friday, we'll have our Trainer Talk replays from 3 to 6 and our Express Bet Weekend Stakes preview from 6 to 7. For our producer, Lee Delapina and Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.
Good night, Barbados.